Good morning. I think we'll get started. I want to first thank everyone for getting up and being here at 8 a.m. on Saturday morning after the reception last night. It's much appreciated. I'm Mary Ailings. I am the Archivist for Digital Collections at the Bancroft Library.
Well, welcome to our session, Revolution of Access, the Online Archive of California Interface Redesign. As the title sets out, we're here this morning to talk about the redesign of the Online Archive of California interface. As one of the earliest online sites for access to EAD finding aids, the OAC website has gone through many changes over the years, and the current redesign is just the next step in that evolution. As the title also implies, we hope that the evolution will also be somewhat of a revolution in how we provide access to finding aids. And while the redesign is still underway, we hope that what we'll show you today can demonstrate how we're hoping to take the finding aid access to the next level. And my role today is to first introduce the speakers, and then second, I'll give you a historical overview of where the OAC has been, and then my fellow panelists will talk about where we're going to be going. First, I'd like to introduce our Rosalie Lack. Rosalie works as the Director of Digital Special Collections at the California Digital Library. She's responsible for the Online Archive of California, as well as Calisphere and the UC Image Service. She's been with CDL for 9 years, and Rosalie holds a Master's of Information Management from UC Berkeley. Rachel Hugh, down at the end there, works as a User Interface Design Manager at the CDL, facilitating the design process across several groups at CDL. She has an MS in Information from the University of Michigan with the degree specializing in human-computer interaction and archives and records management. So a very nice blend. She most recently worked with JSTOR as a user services lead on projects such as Portico, and as well as a JSTOR redesign. So she has a lot of experience with this. Since coming to CDL late last year, she's been working on the OAC redesign with the Special Collections group. And finally, myself. As I said, I'm the Archivist for Digital Collections at the Bancroft Library. I've worked there for 12 years on digitization efforts, as well as various other collection management activities. I'm responsible for all the EAD creation and creation of digital objects, as well as the maintenance and presentation of those online. Before coming to the Bancroft, I worked in museums in San Francisco and Baltimore, so I sort of came from a different community and moved into libraries, and I actually have an master's in art history with concentration in art documentation and conservation. In addition to my regular job, I also teach at the School of Information Science at Syracuse University as an adjunct faculty and teach a graduate program or course in digital collections. So that's my side job. I'm also a member of the OAC Redesign Advisory Committee, and that's the hat that I'm wearing today. And I'm going to begin today by giving you a little tour of where the OAC started. And I'm sorry, I'm a little congested this morning. Okay. Oh, yes. Many of you, if you've been part of the OAC, will remember this. The Online Archive of California, or OAC, as we will no doubt be referring to it most of this morning, includes finding aids and digital text and images from collections held in institutions throughout the state of California. The OAC website had its humble beginnings as a project of the Bancroft Library back in the early 1990s. Starting in 1995, the UC EAD project developed a large collection of EAD finding aids from UC institutions across the state. The project then expanded to include collections from other California institutions, such as the California Historical Society, the California State Universities, the Getty, and many others. In 1997, the UC EAD collection was renamed the Online Archive of California, and the first OAC website, OAC 1.0, was based on an electronic book software called DynaWeb. DynaWeb DynaWeb, being a book-centric software, was difficult to navigate. The presentation structure of DynaWeb was hierarchical, which seemed to a natural way to present finding aid groupings and finding aids themselves. The interface was pretty basic, didn't have a lot of bells and whistles, and truth be told, there weren't a lot of choices out there at the time. So this is where it started. Users would need to drill down collection after collection. See, now I lost my place because I used the wrong key. One moment, please. And here we have a finding aid. They would drill down through the finding aid, down through all the descriptive front matter, and then finally arrive at an item or the digitized content. Considering that finding aids had previously only been available in paper form in reading rooms prior to this, this was a significant improvement in access to archival description. To this point, any digitized content was linked in the finding aid structure, meaning that to get to it, users had to traverse the hierarchy in the finding aid to get them get to the images or any digitized content, which was certainly not user-friendly. In 1997, the CDL was established to provide access to shared digital collections that support the university's research and teaching missions, the CDL being the California Digital Library. In 1998, the OAC officially moved from the Bancroft and became a project of the California Digital Library, where it remains today. At the time, the design of the interface did not change much beyond the addition of the CDL logo down there in the bottom right, and then later, the OAC logo at the top. And here you can see an attempt to differentiate for the users the finding aids and the digitized content, and then also the addition of descriptions. So there's an attempt here compared to the previous view to provide some context and some description for users to tell them what a finding aid is. So you can see that as soon as these things went online, the user response was, well, what's a finding aid? And where's the digital content? So the differentiation was the Online Archive of California was finding aids, the OAC Virtual Archives was a subset of the OAC that had digital content, and then the electronic texts were also broken out. So this was an attempt to move the search box up, you know, brand it as the OAC, and then to give some sort of context to what we're doing here. But still, in all, the OAC 1.0 left a lot to be desired, because you were still working in DynaWeb. So the transition from OAC 1.0 DynaWeb to the new OAC 2.0 to DLX system took place in July of 2002. This gave OAC a new look and feel, much as it looks today, and a more user-friendly interface than the DynaWeb. And as part of this release, digital objects were removed or extracted from the EAD and became digital objects that could be searched independent of the EAD. So they were removed from within the structure of the EAD, encoded within the EAD, and taken out and encoded as MOA2 and now later METS objects. So this was the first time that the OAC started to pull these things apart and allow separate searching of them. Well, this was an improvement over DynaWeb, certainly. It had some issues, including not being able to sort search results in relevance order. And after some usability testing, it became clear that DLXS was not going to be a long-term solution for the OAC. And here's just a view of where those images were separated out. The CDL and the OAC Operations Group announced the release of the Online Archive of California version 3.0 in February of 2005. The XTF-based system, or Extensible Text Format system, provided better searching, indexing, and access, as well as revised object views. The XTF platform, developed and maintained by the CDL using open source software, provides greater long-term functionality and flexibility for the search and delivery of a wide range of document types, including finding aids, EAD finding aids, and TEI texts. So OAC 3.0 includes the following features. delivery of EAD 2002, finding aids, which are now in XML, and searching within EAD and within TEI views, as well as updated search and object views. This is a search, thank you, resulting in images of the image search, and then here's the object view. Improving search capabilities and the sorting of EAD and TEI search results by relevance, date, and publisher information was a great improvement. And here we have the view of the finding aid in the XTF view. And we can go down to a record. We still see the description of the record within the EAD structure. And then when we click on it, we get the view of the image. This image can also, this digital object, which is a METS object, can be searched independently as well. And then here's another object view, the most current. Okay. In August 2006, CalSphere was released, which provides access directly to digital objects, as well as reaching out to a more general audience, K-12 students and teachers. This now frees up the OAC to become what it has always been at its core, a portal to finding aids, to archival and other collections throughout the state. One of the benefits of contributing to OAC and CalSphere is that we send one XML file that is used and can be used in multiple interfaces. It can be used in the OAC, CalSphere, as well as themed websites. The power of XML and standards like METS and EAD allow this to happen, and in combination with the XSLT, the transforms, and style sheets, we're able to improve our access and presentation quite significantly. Okay. And I think here's an object search through CalSphere, and again, you get to that object view. Okay. So as long as technology keeps moving, I think we're always going to see evolution of these websites. And now that we have the occasion to put in things like Web 2.0 capabilities, it's nice to be able to see the evolution of where we've come from and where we're going. So I will, at this point, turn it over to Rosalie. Thank you.
So it's really great to sort of remind myself again about the origins of OAC, I think, to see from the DynaWeb how we had the images integrated in this, whatever we could find, which was this book metaphor software, and then working our way down to separating the images from the finding aid, which I think is a pretty interesting new development. So thanks, Mary. So I'm going to just focus, I'm going to really kind of briefly talk about the background of the OAC redesign, and then turn it over to Rachel to give you more sort of concrete screenshots of our early wireframes and what we're going to be doing. And just as Mary pointed out, I just have some numbers to give the sense of the size that we have. There's around 9,000 EAD encoded finding aids in OAC, with attached approximately 200,000 digital objects. And the strength is, or the most of the objects are images, but there are a good percentage of text also. We have over 100 contributing institutions from across California. And this really, really long URL is our project page if you want to go and get updates of where we are in our redesign. But broadly, this is our timeline that we're hoping to stick with. And we did pretty extensive planning in fall 2007, which again, Rachel will kind of walk you through. And we're currently in this phase of working with the graphic designer, with user interface design, again, that's Rachel, and usability activities through currently really in this month. And we're hopeful to release a prototype in September, kind of pretty limited release that's not going to be live, but really just released within our community. And we're trying this model of actually releasing and having the two up at the same time, but again, not publicly available, the two of them, to really allow our contributors, because we have over 150 or so of them, and we really want to make sure what we've done meets their needs. So we're giving them a pretty long time to look at the interface, report bugs, and give suggestions for ways we might do things differently. And then the launch, live launch of March 2009, is really tentative depending on what they find. I mean, if they find major issues, of course, we're going to move that timeline out. But I think it's a model we haven't really used before. But I think given that we are an aggregator and the content comes from our contributors, I think it's a good idea. So we'll see. And we've really drawn on the expertise across the UC campuses to help us with this redesign. And this is kind of a long list, but we have most campuses represented, and really very rich expertise of archivists and librarians across the UC system. And also we pulled in Jody from the Northwest Digital Archives to be on our committee also. So I just wanted to just pull back at this point that Mary just mentioned about Calisphere, just to reiterate this, and that what this was really was part of our impetus for, you know, sort of why now with this redesign. And Calisphere is part of the reason, because we've released the site in, I guess maybe it's been 2 years now, and this site really is focusing on the digitized objects that are in the OAC. So the beauty of it really is we have one, I like to call it VATO content, so we have one large repository. The items only sit one place, the finding aids and the objects, but you have two views of that same content. So it's really a great economy of scale, or maybe that's a scope, I don't know. But anyway, that we're not duplicating our content to have two websites. It's just two views of the same content. And why would we do this? Basically because we have two very different audiences. So you need really, we found out in our user evaluations, you really need two sites. And we're seeing that the online archive, of course, is really geared toward archivists, historians, researchers, whereas Calisphere is more of a K-12 site and also sort of general public undergraduates. And to be clear, these are really roles, because sometimes a historian can be like the general public. They just want to get online, they just want a digital object, they're in and out. And vice versa, a K-12 teacher can also do research, particularly high school teachers. They might want to be on the OAC, so these are really roles that people are playing. And we found that sort of the main difference of how it's in the access of how they get into these. So on the left, you see, or maybe that's the right. No, that's the left. You see the OAC, and that is, it is a finding aid site, and the primary access point is through, first, the finding aid, and then you go down the hierarchy of the finding aid, and you may or may not, of course, find digital objects. In OAC, in the most cases, you won't. I think we figured 5 to 10% of our finding aids have digitized content. Versus Calisphere, where the primary entrance is the digital object first, but we always keep the connection back to OAC. So if you were to click, hard to read, but on the right there's a more information about this image link. And if you click that, you would get more information and a link back to the finding aid. So the connection is always there for you to go and get more context if you want it. But if you just want the first entrance, the digital object, then this is the way to go. I had another thought there, but it just went right out of my head. Got to have those notes on 7:30 or 8:30. Well, I guess that was it. So broadly, I just wanted to, I just have a couple slides here to finish up, to kind of talk about, I was looking at this slide this morning, like, what are the problems? Well, what an existential question. What are the problems, people? I tell you, there's a lot of them. So what are the problems? In the context of this presentation, what are the problems? So I mean, of course, we have a million problems, and you're always trying to solve them, but what I really try to put on these slides are problems, I think, that are we've heard and actually really reheard here at this conference that we're all having with our finding aids and having our digital objects and attached, and, you know, there was a great talk with a great title, Why Can't I Click on It? And I thought, that is it. That sums up one of our major areas. Why can't I click on it? I like that. So what these slides are, just sort of going over broadly, what are we trying to solve with this redesign? Oh, yeah, I remember the other point, that the idea of why the Calisphere OAC, having the Calisphere site, really has helped us focus on what is the OAC, and that it is a finding aid site. And we're saying that out loud. And we're not going to send K-12 teachers there or just the general public. That was sort of my point. And that having the two sites has really clarified the goal for each one. And it's really helped us in the OAC redesign, because now we know exactly who the audience is and what they need. So
Sorry to do that, but I just remembered that. Anyway, okay. General usability issues, that's one of the reasons, that, you know, over the, as Mary pointed out, the site's been out since really 2002, and we've gotten feedback on things that we fix as we can, but there are things we keep putting on the list that, like, when we get to it, we're going to really work on those. So those are just this clump of a lot of those general things, really probably particular to our site, that we need to just work on. And, I mean, of course, the huge, the finding aid navigation can be problematic in that it, this hierarchical structure and, you know, how do we get in there? And when you, and again, Rachel's going to really talk more details about this, but you sort of get down in the finding aid and then where are you, you know? And it can be unclear to users that we're, what we are, basically, that we're really an aggregation of content. So this is something we really have to help users to understand. I mean, we actually have the records of the DMV, and I can't tell you how many people have asked us for their driver's license. It's like, no, we don't have that. We just have the records. So it's, you know, these kinds of things, really trying to clarify that. And, of course, this is one of the big ones. They're confused of what's online and what isn't. You know, why can't I click on it? And so that's to me, that feels like even coming out of this conference here, we ought to solve this one. We're going to get, Rachel's going to come up with something brilliant, and I can't wait. this sort of the partner one is that users are just not getting that most of our content, in fact, is not online. And it's interesting, we're working with a graphic designer who is not working in the library or the archive world. And we sat down with him, Glenn, and he's brilliant. I love Glenn. But and we're like, oh, we're building this site for this stuff that's not online. And I mean, I probably took about two meetings. He was like, why is this site useful? And it just, even just the mental model of how, I mean, OEC is incredibly useful for the right audience. But someone who's not in that world, he couldn't even grasp it. It was really interesting to try to explain to him what this site is for and who should use it and who should be here. And sometimes there's people who know they should be there, but they don't quite get how to use it. And those are easier. It's the people who should be there but don't know it. That's the hard audience, because there are some people that undergraduates, for example, they might just want the digital image, but they probably ought to, if they want to do a real research paper, go to the Bancroft, for example, and actually be there, but they don't know that. So that's actually a trickier audience, too. So, and then this issue that we heard confirmed several places, I think Northwest Digital Archive has done some work, and they're seeing this also, that most of our users are really dropping in right in the middle. And they fall into our finding aid. They don't start on our homepage with our what's a finding aid information. You know, they're starting like right at they drop right into the finding aid homepage. And so it has to be clear from there who we are and what this is and what's going on. So that one's tough too. And our current search we have with OAC is pretty limited. We're not offering a lot of options at this point. Part of our problem really is a metadata problem, aggregating content from over 100 and something institutions, and there isn't necessarily consistency in dates. And in fact, we did a study of our metadata, and I think the only thing that was consistently there, and that wasn't even there all of the time, was title. That was it. We had a lot of missing dates and no subject headings and stuff like that. So that's a little problem. But we've kind of come up with somewhat of a solution, again, that Rachel will talk about. Well, it's not somewhat. It is a solution. It is a solution. And we wanted to join the 21st century with our website. We thought it would be interesting to provide some things that people regularly see on the internet. But, you know, when I would tell my friends, well, I'm not going to give it away what we're going to do because Rachel's going to talk about it. But I'd say, oh, we're going to do this. And they're sort of, duh. That's on every site. But for us, it's new. So we want to really kind of bring some of that in, not just gratuitously, but to really serve for the needs and what we want to do with our users. And currently, as I said earlier, the EADs are really what our finding aids are all EAD finding aids. And we're really seeing, of course, we have a lot of MARC finding aids, and they're in our OPAC or in our, you know, campus OPACs. And so, we have a union catalog, the Melville catalog at UC. So we are we're going to try to bring in and bring together the MARC and the EAD into OAC. And we did an initial pull of records from Melville,
and got around 25,000 records. So we're not going to be 9,000 finding aids. We're going to be 30,000. So it'll be pretty amazing. So it's the MARC collection records, but also item records that are relevant. And we're really just starting that to figure out how to pull the right ones and how that's all going to work. But I'm pretty excited because I think it's going to be great to have those together. And for just these are the things that are not exciting, but exciting for us to just upgrades to our infrastructure. And also our contributors. You know, it's their content and their tool, and we really want to support them. And so in this upgrade, we're going to really provide some new tools for them that will allow them to update their information and ingest their items and be able to see where they are in the process and things like that, just to better support our contributors. And this issue that I brought up at the beginning is that we want to make sure that we have we're explaining what the difference between OSC and CALISphere. I mean, I explained it to you. You got the talk, but many people don't get that difference, and it's for us to figure that out. And actually, one thing that we're thinking of doing is putting a banner ad, on OAC for CALISphere that basically says, do you just want a digital object? Go here. So that those folks who shouldn't be there just leave and go where they need to go. And so we'll see how that works. I'm not sure how that's going to be, but we'll see. I think that might be, you can't ask me questions now because we're going to move on. But save your questions. Thank you. Okay, can everyone hear me? Okay, great. This actually needs to be here. All right, good to go. As Rosalie mentioned, good morning, everyone. It's been really interesting for us to sort of attend the sessions at our meeting this year to learn about the design process and user needs questions that are coming up, you know, facing all of us in our efforts to sort of provide online access and to put our records online. And so every day we're taking new possibilities away. We attend sessions here and we're going back and thinking, we really need to work on that as well. So what I'm going to do today is share a snapshot of the process that we used and show you some of the questions and scenarios that we faced and that we thought through as we created our future wish list. Our first designs of the reworking of the OAC site. And you can probably see a lot of similarities. And I use that word rework really consciously because while we want to push the limits of this sort of Web 2.0 world that we're all living in, we also really wanted to get down to basics, to that primary goal of the users who are coming to our site. They just want to get in, get the sources that they need, and they want to go back and work on their research. Those are some of the things that sort of really drove our design effort. So as we started our redesign process, we took a little time to orient ourselves to the work that had been done in sort of online finding aid displays in the field in the past few years. We did a literature review of project case studies. We did a comparative analysis. We looked at American Memory. We looked at NWDA. But beyond that, we sort of wanted to move beyond the archival world as well and really look at sort of ubiquitous applications and commercial sites and especially the way that commercial sites maybe had to work with content-heavy, data-heavy content bases. So, for example, we looked at online book presentations as they exist today in 2008 and sort of looked at the mechanisms that they used to sort of show users where they were when they were in a large body of content. And could we use some of these ideas in our redesign? When we went into this redesign effort,
We didn't want to just learn how users used OAC, but how OAC fit into their larger research workflow. How did they enter OAC? What points had they covered before they arrived at OAC? And then sort of where did they need to go to supplement things that we couldn't provide for them, so that we had a really deep understanding of our place in their research workflow. And as a result, we did contextual interviews, groups discussions, one-on-one sessions, and we uncovered three main groups, reference archivists from our contributing institutions and maybe beyond. These are the people who use OAC on their day-to-day sort of workflow when they have to look up and do reference for patrons that come in. And they use mainly OAC to search their own contributed content. And then we have the expert researchers, the researchers who, because of their course of study, they need to go in and work with primary source materials, and perhaps they've visited other archives and they're somewhat familiar with the way that materials are stored and described, and they have concept, that construct of the container list in their mind already. So what we learned from the reference archivist and the expert researcher group was that they would use their library OPAC to sort of do broad topic searching, and then they would sort of use OAC to just hone in on specific collections. And sometimes they would also link directly from a MARC record in the library OPAC directly into the collection level page at OAC. A new sort of emerging user group, as archive records are being surfaced up to the network level, are the novice researchers who are being dropped in, who are doing broad sort of general topic searching on commercial search engines, as Rosalie mentioned. And so they're being dropped in at the collection level page, and maybe what they need is a primary source, but we're still sort of having to introduce to them. Exactly. So one of the things that we wanted to sort of streamline our project deliverables, we wanted to spend time talking to users and working on the redesign, and so we didn't want to spend a lot of time sort of coming up with massive project documentations that would have to be changed because we were working through an iterative process. Things would be taken out and deleted, and so this was our way to sort of be as spare as possible in our documentation. We had personas, but we didn't make full-blown stories where you have fake pictures of people and stories about their children or their cars that they drove. It was just a basic functional layout, short and sweet, so that our project team could understand what the goals were and what their normal workflow was. And then also in our desire to fix the wrongs of our site that Rosalie mentioned, we kept a list of do's and don'ts. You know, don't have too much white space, don't have long scrolling pages, to really sort of keep in mind, and that was sort of put on the wall as we were working on our redesign. Another thing that we did was have a requirements list. Not a requirements document, but just a list with a column for effort and a column for prioritization. And the effort column could be graded low, medium, high, and the same with the prioritization column. The effort column was graded by our technical staff. You know, how hard is this item going to be to create? How much development time is it going to take? And then the priority column was something that we sent out to our working group to sort of help advise us. How much of a priority is this to our community and to our users? So very quickly, you could see things sort of easily rise up to the top of the list and then drop down to the bottom. And just because something was easy to do didn't mean that it was a high priority and that you should do them. And this list was a good way to work with our distributed team, so you didn't have to work with massive track changes in a Word document, which can get kind of nightmarish. Another thing that we did was we built interactive wireframes and specifications to help our project team sort of visualize the design solutions. And this is an example of that. As you can see, it's a way to sort of lay out a bare bones layout of the page. And then you can also do sort of click-throughs so that a go button next to your search bar would actually click and go to the next search results screen. And then you can see there are also little note fields that you could do to enter in specifications so that your project team has the layout and the specification on what that widget is doing all in one place, and they don't have to flip back and forth. And so those are sort of some of the things that we worked on. And as you can see, so we're moving into sort of the problem areas and how we addressed them. This is a screenshot of our current finding aid page. And some of the problems that we had with this was the finding aid navigation. The collection titles tucked way up in the top left-hand corner, sort of hidden. And then the finding aid itself is split into multiple pages, so users have to sort of click back and forth to find the information points that they need. And also, they were built on long scrolling pages. So once you scroll down to the bottom, so even that problematic navigation list, you'd lose that too. So you would have no way of getting back out and understanding your context. And of course, you would sort of lose the context of where you were. And so this is an attempt at an early wireframe that we built to address that. So right now we have sort of static pieces of the site, a header with collection title, collection number, institution name, record number up at the top, and we also have on the side there a navigation bar, and those areas sort of remain static as you have a main content area where you can actually scroll and see the main body of content. So no matter where you are within the finding aid, or we like to call it the collection guide now to help those novice users who don't really understand that terminology, you always have your navigation and your sort of contextual information there. We also had that issue of scrolling through your container list. We looked at a number of solutions. We looked at the tree views, and you know, we thought, well, what's actually the most transparent way of showing the container list? So we're having it sort of, our first design solution was to load the entire container list within that main content area and to be able to use the right-hand navigation to either click through or to be able to scroll through. And as you're scrolling through, you have that header area telling you which series or container area you're in. And so that's constantly up there as well to sort of ground you and, you know, tell you where you're going. Another solution, another sort of don't that we heard, or...
Can I just butt in? That is so cool. That series flips. That it moves as you scroll. It's a dynamic thing. I don't know how our programmer did it, but I love it.
And one of the things that we heard was that people want to be able to view the entire finding aid view, which they can do on our current site, but there was no good way to print or save it or download it, and so we're generating PDFs for them to do that. And as well, another thing was that when they were searching inside the collection guide, they wanted to be able to search the online images alone. And they can do that. It's a functionality that's available, but it's not visible on our current interface. And so what we did was we pulled that out into radio buttons so it was really clear what you were searching. As Rosalie mentioned as well, we have MARC records now, and so we have collections and we have items. And how are we going to show these? I don't know. It's a good question. Our first attempt is to sort of separate them out into tabs. And we've been taking, so you'll have the default, the collection view tab, and then an item view tab. But, you know, as we say, we're learning as we're going. So we're going out on the road and we're doing some user tests and we've been getting some initial feedback and, you know, maybe this isn't the best way. Maybe this is confusing for people. So we're going to take that information and rethink it. But this was sort of like our first sort of thoughts about it. We also have a facet area on the search results. And as Rosalie mentioned, you know, that sort of need to search by dates that a lot of end users have. You know, there's because of the long date ranges that are available for each collection, you know, it's kind of hard to start that on the search query side of things. And so one way that we had to sort of alleviate that, mitigate that just a little bit, is to be able to allow them to refine their search results by institution, by date, and also by online item availability. So the dates have been split into decades because there's a way that our programmer after the fact can sort of duplicate the decades within the date ranges, and so that they can sort of help refine their searches a little bit, and then this makes more sense to the end user. Another thing that we want to do is modernize our display, and so we wanted to incorporate the dynamic maps that you see everywhere, but this, it wasn't just, you know, in our effort to really sort of bring Web 2.0 features in, not because they're fancy, but because they're useful. This was a way to really ground our users in the fact that you have to go to these places, and here's a map here, and it's over here. And so another alternate browse path that we came up with was the dynamic Google map that you see with Zoom and sort of move map capabilities. And you can actually see where each institution is plotted out on our map. And you can also, this is like an alternate browse path where you can click through and you can get driving directions to that institution or BART directions to that institution. And you can also sort of drill down and see how many collections they have. And this is just an alternative way to sort of get down into the collection level. We're also thinking about commenting. Adding a way for users to sort of comment on collections, whether that's at the collection level, whether that's at the object level, you know, we're not really sure yet. And we're talking to users about that, and, you know, some of our expert researchers are, well, how valid are these comments going to be? How authoritative? Is it just anybody's going to be commenting? Is it the staff that will be commenting? And so, you know, we're thinking about these questions and sort of, you know, maybe it's something that we just put up and see what the usage is and let that tell us, you know, is this something we want long term or is it just like an experiment that we want to, like, say we tried it and say we have some real data that it didn't work or it worked. But anyway, right now we're sort of all about testing. We're in that, we've come full circle. We started with the user and we're back to the user now. And some of the things that we did early on was paper prototyping as we were designing. Which is a way of sort of printing out your paper wireframes or your early designs and showing them to people. And people think that they need a full-blown interactive site to actually get good user feedback. That's not the case. You can get some really good information about basic layout, task flow with, you know, a paper document. And it sort of doesn't cost very much. And you can do it early on. But we are, as we are sort of building our functionality in, we're also starting sort of our detailed task-based usability testing, and we just finished with our expert researcher group. We did a small sampling of them last week, and we're in the middle of sort of going through all the results and really understanding what we're hearing from them and what we want to change and rework. We're also sort of learning as we're going, really. A couple of weeks ago, for example, we attended a forum, and we learned about these archival metrics toolkit surveys that are being put out by Beth Yackel and Helen Thibault and Wendy Duff. And while those surveys are sort of geared more towards archives and their services, there was an online component to it that could really help us contextualize which users we're hearing things from. For example, one expert user who's further along in their studies might really understand the content area and the materials very well. So they navigate the container list with ease, whereas another expert researcher, they're kind of earlier on, and so they don't really know the material as well, so they have trouble navigating. And so is it that they have more knowledge or not? And so it was important to sort of contextualize our users to be able to understand, you know, is this thing, you're saying that it works well, but are you saying that because you actually know the materials very well, or is it because the interface is actually working? So those are some of the things that we're sort of covering. We also sort of will go into an extended test period, as Rosalie mentioned, with our working group and with our contributors to really test out our interface. And we also plan on doing ADA compliance testing on our website because it's very sort of JavaScript heavy to get these interesting, fun, like maps and scrolling things to work properly. It's a JavaScript heavy site. But we're going to work with the UCLA's Disabilities and Computing Center and have them really evaluate our site and give us recommendations on how we can make alternative versions so that all people can access them. So, you know, stay tuned. And these are my image attributions. Stay tuned to our efforts, and we hope to be going live in 2009.
Well, do we have any questions for our panelists? Yes. Okay, the question was about back-end upgrades for contributors and those tools.
Some of the things we were hearing from our contributors is that they send us their finding aid, and then it sort of goes into a black hole. It's like, when's that going to go live again? And so we're trying to figure out a way to keep them informed of when their item goes live. And one thing we were thinking you know, would they want maybe an RSS feed? Or I mean, we're not really sure what the solution is, but that's one of the problems we want to solve so that people can know when they put something in when it will be online. That was kind of a big thing. And also just updating their now we are in this new interface really focusing on their contact information. We want their phone numbers. We want their fax numbers and their email, and which we didn't have on the old OAC. And so we really need tools for them to update them themselves. Otherwise, it will become an administrative nightmare for us to keep that up to date. So that's one thing. It's sort of an online interface so they can update their contact information. And also even their Google map, we need them to go in and make sure we've got the bubble in the right place because there's I won't go into why that
well,
is. But
can I comment on that? Because as a library that's been off-site for 3 years, being able to update our address without changing it in every finding aid would be a really great thing for the 3 years we're off-site. So that's kind of a difference between what goes in your finding aid.
Yeah, so once you update it once in this interface, it would just change throughout the finding aid, all your finding aids, your address and phone number and everything would change. One thing we'd like to add is new fields that maybe you don't normally put in your finding aid, for example. Like we're thinking about asking folks to give us a URL where it's like your before you come to the archive URL page, or you know, so that you find an object you want to go there and you click this URL, and then it takes you not just to the home page of the institution, but right down in your site to if you have such a page that prepares a researcher for coming to your institution. So that's sort of a new field that again we can gather in this sort of really a contact database with an online interface, basically.
And that reinforces that fact that they have to go to a physical location to get many of these materials versus what's online.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the highlights of those.
So the question is, what is the printout going to look like? Good question.
We're going to have an HTML version, a printable HTML version, and the PDF version. And I think we're thinking, and Rachel can get me, on the HTML, it's just all the way through, just like straight down, which I don't know if that's clear. But on the PDF version, we're going to customize that so that the series changes with each page. So when you're on page 3, if you're on series 3, and then when you're on page 5, you're on series 4. So the header is dynamic in the PDF. So it's a header in the PDF that will actually be dynamically changed as you flip through the series, but the HTML version will just be straight through printable version and less white space. I mean, I know it's hard to even say out loud less white spaces, isn't that really cool? But on our current OAC, there's a lot of white space. If you've looked at it and you think white space is good, usually it is good as a design principle, but there's way too much on ours. And so if you have these printable versions and even our new HTML version will have less white space so that, you know, less trees killed when you print. So.
And I think the idea is that when users, you know, want to just print out one page, they'll have the collection name and call number and all that information, so they only have to bring that one page in, not the entire document.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. On the PDF, we're going to have a footer that's the institution name and the collection number. That's constant on every page of the PDF. So, yeah, you could open a PDF and just print page 10 right, and have the institution, the call number, the current series in the box, everything right there. So, yeah.
Anyone else? So the question is the answer for different types of users to have two sites or
different views?
You know, I've thought about that because I've sort of looked at the range of possibilities out there. But for this particular iteration, what we wanted to do was provide areas on each page that sort of answered a different user's needs. So for example, the default view for things were something that would invite the novice user in. But there's also other areas that you could click on that would provide that richer information that the reference archivist or expert researcher is interested in. So our approach for this particular one was to combine it and not have completely separate views, because we had such limited real estate and it had to work across an aggregate data set. And so in this particular attempt, no, it was a combined view.
And otherwise, other than the broad Calisphere OAC breakdown, right. Yeah, you were talking about within the finding aid, yes.
Yes.
So to kind of follow up on that question, is there agreement amongst the advisory committee as to the philosophical approach in terms of reference and what our obligations are? In other words, a lot of the points you're bringing up about, for example, a novice user being dropped down into the middle of a finding aid, that's analogous to, you know, 30 years ago, walking into a library and not knowing how to use a card catalog. So you've got to have that library instruction. You've got, you know, there's always going to be an element where you've got to have an opportunity to talk to your reference librarian and whoever and have that library instruction. So I'm just, are you still assuming that that's the, or are you trying to break that pattern that's always been there historically? Even in graduate students, they don't get, now you're going to hear a bias comment, they don't get research methods, so they may know to use finding aid. So how far do you need to go, or should you go, and let the rest of the work be to the reference archivist, to the faculty member that's teaching those students?
Yeah.
Is there agreement on consensus?
Okay, and the question is whether there's agreement about how much reference interaction is going to take place. And I mean, I can answer somewhat from our perspective, which is, I mean, and one of the reasons I like the fact that there isn't a separate site for novice and expert users is that our archivists and our reference archivists spend a lot of time walking people through those sites. If they use it themselves, they become the expert users and they can teach the novice users who need that site how to use it if needed. And that's often coming in through emails and you know, people at the desk often will sit down and do that work right in the library. So I sort of see that role still continuing. But yes, I mean, educating our users on, or educating researchers how to do research online is also good. But having the two different sites is because there are really different users. Those yeah, very general users just don't really want the finding aids. They don't understand what they're for. They just want the stuff. And then you've got the people who want the finding aids. So it's nice that there's this separation. At least from our perspective, it's great. And then blue shirt. Have we considered using Google Analytics to analyze users? I'll
let them answer. At CDL, we actually, in our group, we're using a program called AW Stats, which I guess this is recorded, but I don't know. It's not as cool as Google Analytics, and the paid version of Google Analytics is Urchin. I'm speaking a little bit not knowing what I'm talking about, but you might want to pay for Google Analytics because I just feel nervous that Google now has your usage stats. I don't know. I don't mean to be paranoid, but if you pay for the paid version, the Urchin version, it looks exactly the same, but more functionality, and then you keep your stats on your server versus having them at Google. So that's something to consider with your statistics. And I think that Google Analytics is useful. They do have some, and then of course, in turn, the Urchin version, they do provide some stats for a user going through your site. You can see their click path, which, for example, AW Stats does not provide. So, I mean, any stats is better than none. And so, you know, we can see things like where people are coming from and what things are most used. But seeing user behavior and a click path of an individual user is actually pretty powerful. And I think that's only in sort of the Google products. I mean, I'm sure it's in other products, but it's not in AW Stats. So I kind of answered it.
On user studies, how did we find users and how do you conduct the user studies?
It's a lot of legwork. We are lucky, I guess, in that because we are part of the UC system, we can call on some of our colleagues on the UC campuses to help us sort of do that a little bit. But I've also, one of Rosalie's friends had a great idea to go to Craigslist. And there's a way, we had a really good way of giving people an online link that would take them to a survey that would sort of pre-screen them a little bit so that you're not just getting Joe Schmo sending, like 10 million people sending directly things to your email box, you could put times and like get a little bit of sense of what their background was so that you could see if they would be somebody legitimate that would actually give you the feedback that you needed for their demographic.
And money. You have to give them money.
Yeah.
I mean, we gave them, we ended up giving Amazon gift certificates, which was hard for me to do. But we can't actually give money. The university, I mean, we'd have to get your social security number and all this crazy stuff. So we have to give them a gift certificate of sorts. And Amazon really did seem the most what they wanted. So that's what we actually gave. Yeah.
Yes, in the back. So the question is, has the redesign considered being able to use different style sheets to sort on different criteria? The content of the finding on different criteria.
No, that hasn't been on our list, but that sounds pretty cool, actually. That's one of our learning points.
Thanks.
I know, thank you. Yeah, that could be interesting. I mean, I think I'd have to really think about who would want that, though. I mean, it has to be someone who knows what a unit title is, for example. So... they just want to resort somehow. Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I think I would be very, my first step would be some kind of user analysis to that to find out what the sorting would be useful for and for whom. So, but I think that sounds interesting. It's not on our table for this design, but yeah, you do it and let me know.
Are most of these people asking for that experience finding a user?
Okay, one last question, Christian? Yeah, we can do that with our digital objects currently. Skins? Basically, you have different XSLT, extensible style sheet language, and cascading style sheets that you can slap over the XML, and you just get different views of it. So, like on the Bancroft site, we have exhibit websites that call from the CDL digital objects, and they put a different look and feel around them. Different navigation that takes you to our site, not to the OAC. But those things are also available on the OAC as well, and it's all dynamic. So, all right, well, we are out of time, but if you want to have any other questions, feel free to come on up, and thank you all again for coming so early this morning. Thanks.